Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I am Bisha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
Matthew Doc Dunn is a prolific visual artist, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, and singer based in Toronto, Ontario. The man behind Cosmic Range Records and also the band The Cosmic Range, who were in fact the backing band on U.S. Girls' critically acclaimed 2018 album, A Poem Unlimited. Dunn has collaborated with a host of artists and released a slew of music on his own that challenges and defies easy musical categorization. His latest solo effort is called Upper Canada Blues, which has inspired him to play a rare solo show on January 16th at the Baby G in Toronto. Matthew invited me to his home in Toronto, where we discussed his musical trajectory, the downsides of music tribalism and hardcore punk, celebrating heroic cultural figures when we should, his album Upper Canada Blues, his future plans, and much more. A part of the E1 Podcast Network with the support of listeners like you who subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 515th episode of Creative Control featuring the earnestly opinionated Matthew Doc Dunn with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
Hi,
Hi, Matthew. How's it going?
Good, Vish. How are you doing?
Well, thank you for having me in your home.
Oh, thanks for coming up. I appreciate it.
This is you told me to meet you at the studio in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
When I meet Toronto musicians at their studios, it's not as nice as this. You're in a nice home here.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me and the people listening, where are we? What is this place?
We're up in Midtown around Yonge and Davisville. My living room is my recording studio. So it's where we've been working pretty much for the last couple years. The studio I had that I recorded the Lightbourne record and Sacred Lamp and a whole bunch of the stuff that's been surfacing was at my old house on Lightbourne Avenue, which basically the space you're looking at, Vish, was the basement.
Right.
And so it was like, it was a real tape studio.
Right, sure.
You know, kind of classic, subterranean classic. But it is now relocated to the dining room.
Main floor space.
You know, it's a beautiful space. We call it the Manor.
The Manor.
It's the Manor. We recorded a bunch of records here over the years. A couple of the MV records.
Okay.
Yeah, the MV and EE records we recorded here way
back. Okay. Now, for people listening, what does that mean? What is
MV? Oh, it's Matt Valentine and Erica Elder.
There you go.
Who are a couple who I've done work with for the last dozen years here and there. Matt, who's known as MV, he was in the band The Tower Recordings. In the 90s, who are really one of my favorite bands, and connected with those guys, you know, 04, 05, I guess, somewhere like that.
Okay.
And played with them a bunch, especially in the late aughts, early teens, I guess.
Okay.
To speak in those terms. And yeah, we recorded some stuff here way back, and and yeah, I mean, I was rent evicted, and I ended up here.
Well, I think you turned out, it sounds, based on your description of the subterranean recording space, I think you fared well.
Yes, this is definitely a more Tony enterprise.
It's weird that you said that. That's the exact word as I was pulling my car up. I'm like, this is a Tony neighborhood. That's what I thought.
Well, I'm happy our adjectives are on the same page.
No, it's lovely. Now, I know you as something of a multi-hyphenate. You do lots of different things. What are all the things you do in the realms of music and other creative expression?
Well, the music thing, I guess, has got a few Hydra heads, I guess. I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, I guess...
You play everything, right? You can play basically every instrument.
I can play a lot of instruments. I can play, you know, strings and drums are usually the things I start from.
Okay.
Pretty much. I started out as a drummer as a kid, you know, fairly primitive, but...
Do you mean the instrument itself is fairly primitive?
It
is.
No, like I was fairly primitive, uh-huh. but in the truest sense.
I'm a drummer. Every time when you start playing drums, you feel like a caveman.
Yeah.
You're like, bah, bah, bah. And then eventually you pick up.
Eventually it grows.
You refine it a little bit. Yeah.
So drums are the first thing I got into when I was a kid. And then I started playing guitars when I was, you know, 12, 11 or 12, something like that. And you know, I can play those instruments. You know, I play the pedal steel. I'm playing vibraphone a lot lately. You know, I grew up... Actually, that's not really true. Actually, my first instrument was the harmonica. I started playing harp first.
The way I give, like, a four-year-old a harmonica?
No, could kind of play a bit. Like, because, yeah. I've always done this. I still do. I would play along with records. So, you know, we had the Dylan records around. And I think my first exposure was probably seeing... early Beatles when Lennon was playing. I think that was probably my first exposure to it.
Love Me Do or something.
Exactly.
Sure.
You know, I think there's a that great video of them, right? I think that if I could peel it back, I know Ringo definitely influenced me on the drums.
Absolutely.
Just watching him, especially the early stuff. I mean, that's like for a six-year-old, seven-year-old, it's like...
It's kind of the roots of Ramones even there somehow.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Early Ringo, yeah. Or no, early
that,
Beatles.
Yeah, that same energy, right?
Yeah,
just in, you know, it's like uplifting too, you know?
Ringo became known for some pretty unique fills, but I mean, early days, he's just most... I mean, actually, he would always do some fills, now that I think about it, or rolls.
Yeah, he's a great drummer.
I always thought he was a great drummer. I still do.
My retort to anyone who... turns their nose up is it's like, so the guy on every Beatles record's a bad drummer, if he's a bad drummer, then you know, hang it up.
Absolutely, one of my influences. I mean, yeah, those Beatles were good. That was a good band.
Yeah, they could do some things.
They're worth celebrating, I would say. That band deserves more recognition.
Well, I was talking to an engineer last night who I was doing some work with, and we were talking about them. Uh-huh. And the thing that no one talks about is the singing.
Yeah.
I mean, the singing, there aren't really better singers. So.
Well, I mean, I thought the singing was always something else, but then you spend any time with Abbey Road, which everyone's doing. As we're speaking, there's like a reissue coming out.
We were speaking of this last night.
Yeah. So the new, I haven't heard anything they've put out about the reissue, but I just think of, when I think of Abbey Road and some of the stuff they did on that record in particular, which was kind of this weird throwback to their early days. That harmony thing is ridiculous.
Well, this is what we were speaking of last night, because I used to have bootlegs of all that stuff. But yeah, just go through Abbey Road and listen to the isolated vocals,
yeah,
and you aren't going to find better singing. It's beyond the Beach Boys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like,
I agree.
It's pretty shocking. It really is. You know, it's,
yeah,
you know, I mean, not to belabor, the most popular.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it too much, but I'm with you.
But this was a very formative. So
were they like the thing that got you? You say you started as a drummer, so was it Ringo that got you into music?
I remember seeing,
it was the harp. Actually, you said
it was the harp.
Yeah.
But I think that was only because, like, you know, my parents weren't going to just go buy me a drum set.
Harmonicas are much
easier.
Weirdly, I find, like, my kids used to play the harmonicas we gave them. I don't know. It's a harsh-sounding instrument in the wrong hands.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would...
In the wrong mouth, I should say, yeah.
I would play it a lot walking home from school. I had, like, a 20-minute walk.
Wow.
And I would just walk home from school and just toot away. I still have the first one.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
actually.
And... Yeah, I mean, if I have to pinpoint it, I remember seeing... I mean, my mom was always playing, especially my mom, both my parents, but my mom especially, was always playing great music. There's a ton of George Harrison and Leon Russell.
Oh, nice.
All the time.
Nice.
And the Bee Gees for cleaning.
Yeah, just while she's cleaning?
Yeah, housework days we would...
The Bee Gees are specific to cleaning?
It was great. We should put the Bee Gees on and away we'd go.
Well, I wonder why the Bee Gees in particular. It's upbeat, generally.
It's upbeat. It's uplifting.
You're doing horrible work. You need something upbeat,
yeah,
in the background.
Yeah, it's, yeah, steady.
And rhythmic, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
And those brothers Gibb, I mean...
No, they also talk about singing.
Holy jeez.
I don't even know how they did it.
It's pretty outrageous, too.
The Beatles were practically brothers, I always like to
pretty
think.
Pretty much.
There's something about that mode or that range of being siblings. When I think of the... Like, I mean, the Beatles thing was they were obviously trying to sing like the Everly Brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... You become more brotherly as you harmonize.
And also, I think the one thing that's lost in the story with them, not to go back to the Beatles, but I don't think people quite understand, like, where those guys are coming from, especially Ringo, George, and Paul. Like, Liverpudlian,
yeah,
poverty,
yeah, yeah,
in the 40s. Like, I don't think people quite understand, like, the drive that those guys had to,
yeah, to make it.
They didn't have, you know, George and Ringo didn't have running water. You know, they don't have electricity. I mean, it's, you know, it's, so I think that's sort of lost in the story, which, mm, I think is also like the bond, right?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Like, you know, but I was going to say is I remember seeing on Great Movies one night, there's a documentary, The Complete Beatles.
I have that on tape.
With Malcolm McDowell.
I have it recorded. Like, I have a VHS. Yeah. It's one of the first things I taped. When I taped
it... Yeah, we taped it off the TV, too.
I taped it off of PBS, I think.
Oh, right on.
So I had all the interstitial, like, the Beatles were good. Like, they wanted to sell you the Beatles. But that documentary, I still maintain, is my favorite. Until the anthology.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the greatest documentary. Like, I just thought George Martin's figured into it very well.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very heavily, rather. And I just loved it. And the footage was, yeah, I think that's a great documentary.
And I think I was 5 or 6 years old when I saw the first maybe 15 minutes of it, maybe 20 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And the performance in Washington when they're in the round.
Yeah, RFK.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, RFK Stadium. Yeah.
You know, it was like the first date or whatever,
yeah,
of the U.S. tour. And that footage of watching Ringo,
yeah,
shaking the bandstand. I was like, give me some of that.
I'm the same, yeah. I was introduced to them by a cousin. It's the first music I don't know if you have a sense of memory of the first thing you heard. It sounds like you do. But the first thing I heard was definitely them. It was a comp, like a rock. They had these Beatles comps, and one of them was called like Rock and Roll Music
rock
Volume
and roll
music, 1.
Volume 1, of course. Yeah, that was the second one I got.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the first thing I ever heard. It's the first thing I remember. I remember watching some TV, like... are you from Toronto originally?
Yes.
So did you come up on like City Limits, City TV?
Absolutely.
Much Music?
Absolutely. I used to get up at 5:30 in the morning before school in junior high to watch City Limits.
Okay, wow. Amazing. Oh, yeah. So I had the same thing. So I remember seeing music videos, but the first thing I remember hearing was that tape, the Rock and Roll Volume 1. And so, yeah, that's what's got me on this path of listening to music and loving them.
Because the stuff that I can remember when I really draw my mind back is... probably the first music I can really remember is All Things Must Pass.
Oh, wow. Harrison.
Yeah.
This is because of your mom.
Yeah, because it was on, you know, like, and when I'm, you know, that big.
Yeah.
And Leon Russell and George are my mom's favorites.
Oh, nice.
They really are. So, and then years ago, I grabbed a copy of, I can't remember what the record's called. Maybe it's called Lady Blue, but the one with the song Lady Blue, uh-huh. Leon Russell hit. And I hadn't heard that since I was a kid, and I put it on and had like a nearly Proustian kind of thing where it was like, oh, I know all of this. This was on in the background.
It's a part of you.
But it was seeing that Beatles documentary. I remember sort of looking at my folks being like, why haven't you told me about this?
Yeah.
It's like, why you been holding out? Like, and then they, I think it was the Long Tall Sally compilation,
oh, right?
Which is like almost a companion to that Rock and Roll Music.
Yeah,
that was the first tape.
First tape I ever bought from the local Kmart was the Beatles Ballads, which was another.
Oh,
comp.
It's great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. So anyway, the Beatles were good.
The Beatles are a good band,
and that's what kind of got you into this.
Yeah, I mean that was the beginning, and you know. Again, like I was into a bit of all of it. I don't know. So really getting into, because Dylan was the major, like, that's the real TSN turning point for me.
Yeah. Have you seen him? I've seen him a lot.
Yeah, I've seen him 6 or 7 times, I guess, over the years.
I've seen him.
I saw him on my 19th birthday, which was pretty wild.
This is not to be a competitive with you.
No, no.
But I've lost track. I've seen him 60 times.
Oh, far out.
Since like 1997.
Yeah, I mean, he was, until Time Out of Mind, like that whole era when I was, like when I discovered him, I was probably about 9 or 10.
Yeah.
My brother came home with the LP, The Greatest Hits, the classic blue.
Yep.
And I remember my family went out. And I just dropped the needle on Subtrain and Homesick Blues because I was like, well, that's got to be awesome. And I put, and it was like literally eyes spun. It was
same,
it was
same
all
experience.
Over.
Same exact experience.
And I was going to say is, but from that era, because I didn't really have, you know, I was like a little snotty kid. So I didn't have the refined ears to like what he was doing from the late 80s until the late 90s. I just didn't have the ear for it then. It just seemed like he was a shell of what he was.
Right.
And Time Out of Mind was cool. I mean, the reason why I haven't seen him so many times is it's so 50-50. And the last time I saw him, it was so fantastic that I try to just leave it at that.
Hmm.
It's like the last time I saw Neil Young, it was just one of the best concerts I've ever seen in my life.
Where did you see him?
I went to Kingston.
Oh, okay.
With Wolfgang Nessel. Monty Mazzanani, if you know Monty, and his wife Jill Aston. Great people. Monty works with Michael Snow.
Oh, okay.
And just some of the nicest folks. And Monty's father, Jim, who's just a total mensch.
Nice.
We drove to Kingston because I think it was a tour where he skipped Toronto. I think he went around Toronto. It was something like that.
Was he with anyone? Was he with Crazy Horse? Was he by himself?
Well, no. It was him, Chad Cromwell playing drums. Rick Rosas playing bass.
Yeah.
And it was the last tour with Ben Keith. And Ben Keith is my favorite pedal steel player, pretty much. Him and Red Rhodes are pretty much my guys. And it was General Admin in Kingston. So, Wolfgang and I had General Admin seats, and they had seats.
Okay.
And we just walked in. We were the only really psychedelic people in the place. It was great, and we didn't push it through, really, but we got right to the front, and I was as far away from you as we were from Ben Keith the whole show.
Yeah.
And it was like a perfect concert.
I had my similar view, similar configuration at the Air Canada Centre, which is now the big arena is.
You know what? It must have been the same tour.
Well, when I saw him, Wilco was opening.
Okay.
So it was like I think I went to two nights of it at the Toronto big arena in Toronto, and Wilco were opening both shows. They must have been opening that tour. And he did like a day in the life, like he did a Beatles song.
Oh, yeah, he was ending shows with right?
So anyway, I've seen Neil a bunch too. We're talking about Bob and Neil and
rock,
the Beatles and
rock.
But I mean, that's all part of you, and that's fair. But you mentioned the word psychedelic there.
Yes.
And you were the only psychedelic people at the show. And I want to home in on that a little bit, because I feel like I really came to know of you because of this band you have, The Cosmic Range.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what it was. You work with my friend Max Turnbull,
mm-hmm.
whom I've gotten to know. He used to go play as Slim Twig.
Yeah, Max is amazing.
Right. So tell me about, we were talking about early Beatles, mm-hmm. playing a harmonica, getting into multi-instrumental stuff. It does seem to me that late 60s period of that band, or maybe mid-60s period for the Beatles, and psychedelic music in general, and the cultural aspects of psychedelia, that seems to be a big part of you on some level. Is that fair? Is that too much of a pigeonhole?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's too much of a pigeonhole. I mean, all that stuff has had a huge impact. I mean, you know, I always go back to Michael Caroli from Cannes. He, you know, before he passed away, he was like, psychedelic music, all good music is psychedelic music.
That's fair.
And, I mean, one thing I think is a real... our generation is, we are now reaping what we sowed by people, all the tribalism, all these definitions.
The requisite orthodoxy that accompanies
it. Yeah, the uniforms, the terrible attitude. This is also why our generation can't honor anything. Mm-hmm. It's part of why we are losing everybody, but that's a whole other digression.
Yeah.
But this is part of it. And so psychedelic to me... you know, Buddy Holly's psychedelic to me.
Sure.
You know, Cecil Taylor's psychedelic. Bach's pretty psychedelic.
So let's get to that. What is psychedelic, as much as it's something that's open-ended as a term, and you're citing all these examples that people would otherwise assume are disparate,
mm-hmm.
what does that term mean to you? And I only invoke it because The Cosmic Range, to me, blew my mind. And I feel like that's what psychedelia kind of does.
I guess that's what I'm saying, is anything that, like going back to the 60s, where some of this nomenclature sort of comes from.
Yeah.
You know, people forget about, you know, rock and roll, what that term means, and then beat music. People forget about some of this terminology. And so there was beat music, and then there became like psychedelic music, you know? And to me, it's like music for the mind and the body.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, free your ass, you know, and your mind will follow, or free your mind, your ass will follow, vice versa.
Right.
And so, you know, you saying your mind was blown by something that's exactly not the idea, but, you know, because music is an abstract form in every permutation. It's, you know, it and dance, I mean, they're abstract art.
Even in its structured form.
Even its most structured form, they're inherently abstract.
Right.
You can't touch it. It doesn't really exist. So to me, it's, you know, not to get too, you know, highfalutin or anything about this, but that to me is part of this stuff. And I don't really believe in like high art, low art. I don't really believe in any of that stuff. I think that was a total disaster for our generation, completely.
Snobbiness,
and then this notion of tearing down hierarchy. And I'm all for that in a lot of places, absolutely. But it's like, if you tear down the hierarchy completely, and then it's, you know, it's like the Bill Evans quote about free jazz, that the danger with it out of the hands of people who have things to say and who have refined palates, essentially, or being able to acknowledge that someone runs faster than you. I mean, I used to play sports a bit when I was younger, and I learned by getting my nose broken and stuff, you know, odd time here or there, or breaking bones, that there's always someone faster, there's always someone smarter, there's always someone better looking, there's all these things, and accepting that as part of, especially in art, and knowing that that's part of it, and being able to honor the people that are beyond you.
Right.
It's like, you know, like I know I'll never really be as good as Simone Schmidt or Jennifer Castle.
Right.
They're like, find me better songwriters.
Right.
Find me better songwriters anywhere, period. Or Megan. You know, I put those three as like my three.
Meg Remy.
Meg Remy, yes.
U.S. Girls, yeah.
U.S. Girls, pardon me. And, you know, that's. I think that this is a big part of what ended up happening. So then everybody ended up in this tribal place, as I said earlier. It became, you know, all this like cultural baggage with stuff instead of it being like, you know, just people, you know, getting into good music.
What kind of baggage?
You know, I just remember growing up, like Mike Smith from the Cosmic Range, mm-hmm. who's my oldest friend.
Oh, I know Mike, yeah.
Yeah, Mike's my oldest friend. You know, we've been friends for... We're getting close to 30 years.
We've
been friends with each other. And there's no better musician I've ever met. Still to this day, yeah. Michael is...
unheralded in so many ways, but yeah.
He's the best. Yeah. And, you know, he and I really bonded in that time period. We met in the early 90s. And we bonded over just... I mean, we're kind of both jokers in a way. But, you know... being able to be into a bit of everything, you know, the hardcore, post-punk, that whole thing.
Yeah.
I have zero attraction for me in any of that stuff at all. And I thought the attitude with all those people was repulsive.
Huh.
And they ended up with the exact world that they deserve, unfortunately. And
which is what?
You know, people complaining on the internet, people, you know, having no culture.
Huh. Huh.
You know, also those people looking in all the wrong places, because I also think that things are a million times better now than they were in the 60s and 70s. Culturally, there are like, it's like a 10-to-1 ratio of amazing people now than there were then. It's just that people refuse to see it. They refuse to honor it.
Hmm. Those post-punk people you're talking about, I mean, a lot of their opinions were shaped by... like the politics of
the
time.
That's what I'm saying, the baggage or whatever. And sure. I'm just talking about music, so I don't want to talk about politics
okay,
at all.
Okay, I understand.
It's just, who cares?
What, I mean, your new album mm-hmm. is called Upper Canada mm-hmm. Blues, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that evokes a kind of socio-political discussion on some level in this country, in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What does that title mean to you?
I mean, a few things. I mean, all my work... You know, if you go back and you know, I've always tried to write about or base my work on my actual life. You know, that's even sort of what I was saying about trying. You know, I'm obviously a work in progress, but trying to deal with what's in front of me rather than what's beyond, right? Which is even sort of what I was saying about. A lot of our kind of generation, it's like so when is anything going to ever be good enough, you know? I mean, and I'm not talking about kids now, I'm not talking about that, like we're middle-aged, you know, without dating ourselves,
yeah, sure.
You know, but you know, even that David Berman stuff we were talking about earlier, without digressing into that,
yeah.
But you know, so for myself, you know, in the last 10-12 years, I guess I just started making sure that I was writing about my actual environment and where we're sitting right now. You know, we could walk to Upper Canada College in about 15 or 20 minutes. And I didn't grow up where we are right now. I grew up further north up here,
mm-hmm.
sort of right by the border, North Toronto and North York, when those are still,
sure,
you know, pre-amalgamation or whatever. So, you know, the shadow of Upper Canada College was always a real thing. There was always a people trying to be upwardly mobile. Is that what they call it? Like, you know, like seeking affluence.
What is that school known for?
It's very much it's like a boys' school. A very affluent boys' school.
Like a boarding school type thing? A private school?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it was sort of the place where, you know, the most affluent people went. And, you know, in this neighborhood is very strange, especially when we were growing up, because Mike Smith, we grew up not too far from each other. And, you know, our parents were all, like, lower middle class, but you could walk two blocks and there's a mansion.
Right.
And, you know, none of that's... It was quite illuminating because you got to meet all kinds of people, shapes, sizes, colors, from people from everywhere. It's great. But it was sort of... you could feel it, you know. There were very clear boundaries.
Right.
And, you know, places you could pass through, you know.
Yeah.
It's like if I was to go down to Synology Studios, where I work with Jeff McMurrich, to get there from here, I have to go through Forest Hill.
Which is another affluent.
Another incredibly affluent, beyond Tony neighborhood in the city, which is, again, it's like we could walk there in 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
So part of this record, not to digress too much, but part of this record, I guess, in naming it Upper Canada Blues, was being back up here, you know, as I said, sort of a, you know, after being renovicted.
Out of necessity.
Back
in, yeah.
You know, and now in this neighborhood, it has gone from being sort of a quiet suburb, which is sort of how North Toronto... the village, you know,
cause yeah.
It's very much a place, you know, that's sort of what it was. It was like a suburb in the city, and it is now a bustling condominium filled construction nightmare. And it's sort of ramped up that, or it feels like at least it's ramped up that, affluent or, aspirational affluent sort of scene. So you combine that with the fact that we are in old Upper Canada. I mean, this is where we live.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the record isn't, I wouldn't say it's inherently political, but we all know that everything has a touch of it. And I mean, so, you know, sure. I don't know, making like a soul kind of blues, like a soul record in a way, for lack of a better term. I don't know. I mean, rock and roll, soul, I don't know.
I think you've referenced Jesse A. Davis as an influence, right?
Yeah, a huge influence on me.
I hear a little Harry Nilsson. I hear a little John Lennon. You know, I hear... Yeah.
Lowell George was a huge influence on this record. And also growing up here, especially in the 90s, I mean, there was a big part of, you know, this is the bond, I'm sure, with Mike and myself and a lot of our friends from then, is all of our parents were like old hippies, basically, in some degree or another, who, you know, like a friend of mine's mom bought her house up here in the 1971 for, you know, 30 grand.
Mm.
And
it's probably worth a million now.
More than that.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was, so like I said, it was like, you know, people who were just living a, you know, quiet, small life.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, and there was a real, like, kind of hippie culture up here that we weren't really wired into either. We may have been into the music, but it wasn't part of, like, our, you know, We were listening to everything. Like Mike introduced me to jazz when I was 13. If memory serves, the first thing he ever asked me about was Eric Dolphy.
Right.
You know, I mean, he was hyped. He was so advanced. It was amazing. So, what I was going to say is the hippie culture. There was a huge Deadhead thing here, but like kind of the upper middle class,
sure,
variant. You know,
right.
And the people that, and you know, the people that basically created that pushback against classic rock, you know, the people that were so didactic about it, who were so narrow-minded.
Right.
You know, I mean, the Deadheads we used to meet then, because we were all, I mean, we had to keep it to ourselves that we were into those records.
Right.
Because it was like a social disease, and the people that were into it were absolutely repulsive, at least the people we encountered.
Right.
It took me until I met a lot of my friends in the States, you know, Matt and Erica, my friends in Woods, where it felt like a breath of fresh air, because those records were scorned, but it was truly just because of the fans. It was one of those things. Huh. So anyway, this, it relates to this record, I think, in kind of taking on those tropes, because that was very much the environment up here, you know, sort of
yeah.
The Allman Brothers. And it's like, all right, well, I'll make like a classic, you know, we made a classic rock influenced record.
Right.
I don't know. It just seemed to fit somehow in my mind, you know. But Vortex Records that was here. Right. It's like we all, you know, a ton of us. It was my friend Matt Pollock. You know, it was a lot of us that it really informed our culture, because right. We were able to go and buy all these records we're talking about, you know, for a couple bucks. I mean, it was an incredible thing. So I feel like maybe that's part of it, going back into my, you know, it's like, what was the foundational stuff?
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around you in terms of your political stance, because you made this comment about post-punk and people complaining. You've invoked the hippies. You've invoked the deadheads, which is a different kind of hippie.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked about some of the things informing your sense of self and identification in Upper Canada. And I feel like some of the things you're talking about in terms of, and so you have, there's an overt political aspect to what you're doing, I think. However, you seem resistant to the notion of complaining. And I just wonder about the relationship between complaining, and I'm putting it in air quotes, mm-hmm. and being outspoken, being someone who wants to complain as a form of protest, to make things better, to improve things, to speak out. Because I just want to, and maybe I'm being facile about this, mm-hmm. but I'm just trying to draw a connection between some of the things you're saying.
I guess I'm just more talking about...
You've also said the music is just the music on some level.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe all I'm saying with that is 'cause I'm young, I'm speaking in relation to music, I guess, when I'm saying this too. Like,
yeah.
So, you know,
like I do think do you think of your musical expression, whether you're talking about an election or something, like, do you think of your, what you do as being some kind of inherently political statement? You don't think of it that way.
I don't know. I don't really put my, I mean, that being said, take the Cosmic Range.
Yeah.
Also, I'll say this too. I mean, with a lot of the music, it's like, you know, take Poem Unlimited, which me and a lot of the
U.S. Girls record?
The U.S. Girls record that me and the Cosmic Range worked on. You know, some people asked me about that record, and I was like, about on a, sort of on a political level. And I was like, I don't really have anything to say. You can just listen to the record. It's like, you know, just listen to the record. That's all I can sort of say about that one, at least. But take the Cosmic Range. The way I run the Cosmic Range, as best I can.
How many people are in the Cosmic Range?
There's eight of us and Jeff McMurrich producing. So there's basically nine of us.
Okay.
And, you know, everyone's paid the same. I give everyone the same publishing.
Yeah.
It's truly egalitarian.
And a collective endeavor.
Well, I mean, it's truly egalitarian.
Okay.
And everyone's treated the same, and everyone's treated completely specifically how they are.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And so there's no scheming.
Sure.
There's no... this is part of me bringing these people together. You know, it's like... it's like my favorite people here, my favorite musicians to work with, without a doubt, and also some of my favorite people in the world. You know, I'm sure if I was given the, like, you know, you can take a dozen people on a lifeboat, that's it, I'm sure they'd all be in the lifeboat.
Okay, good.
You know what I'm saying?
High praise.
So, but that's, it's sort of, you know, for myself, I'm, you know, I'd prefer just the behavior and the actions to speak for themselves on a political level, however you want to look at that.
Okay.
So that, say, you know, it's like, so how do I feel about labor? There you go.
That's evident in the way you structure the Cosmic Range.
It's self-evident. And I think that the thing that I can bring to the equation is music and art. You know, I think that making beautiful things is a really important thing.
Do you think it has efficacy in sort of the way we, as a society, as we, the way we behave, the way we think? Do you think music and art has that power?
I mean, maybe that's what I was saying about complaining, is that I feel like a lot of people... I spent a lot of years working in record stores, Vish.
Oh.
Yes.
Which stores, if I might ask?
Several.
Okay.
In
Toronto.
Yeah, I did a tenure at HMV, and I got to work with amazing people.
Like the big one?
No, I worked on Bloor Street, Holt Renfrew there.
Okay.
I got to meet Jeremy Strawn, nice. Who is just one of...
One of my oldest friends, actually.
And one of the most amazing people. That's how I know of you.
Yeah.
Is through Jeremy.
Oh, okay.
I think I first spotted your visage at Rockets Red Glare shows.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Who I thought were the best band.
They were amazing.
They were the best band in the country at the time, without a doubt. I mean, they were, you know, head and shoulders. It was just astonishing, you know.
Was Rockets Red Glare a post-punk band?
I don't know. Does it matter?
It just, I'm somewhat fixated on that. Sorry, I don't mean to be.
No, I don't. Well, I mean, maybe hardcore is maybe more the, I, you know what, I'm not to go back to it, but I grew up on jazz, Bob Dylan, country blues.
Me too.
So, a lot of suburban people grinding their teeth. You know, because we got to understand, Steve Cato is one of my very best friends.
Okay.
You know, I met Steve a year after Mike. I love Steve. Steve's an amazing person. And Steve's someone...
I feel like Steve's been on the show. Steve was on the show.
Yeah, a long time ago.
We talked about Block's Recording Club,
which was another egalitarian enterprise.
Yeah.
They actually did cooperative things. Accepting... A lot of stuff. I mean, I'm a big like Roz Talks, Gary Panter's.
Yeah.
Yeah. The manifesto.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I believe in that stuff. It's you know, you have to take care of your people.
Yeah.
And that's part of this stuff. I mean, also, I should say I'm a big part of Meg Remy and I's friendship or connection is being like total film junkies.
Yeah.
Because I also was going to say, when you asked, we got a little digress. Like, I also paint and I do a lot of photography.
I do
a lot of photography. And I always thought I'd become a camera operator. I thought that because I always knew that I'd be doing this sort of slightly off music stuff. Mike and I, we knew this since we were kids. It might be apocrypha or it might be a murky memory, but I remember because his mother was just, she's an amazing lady, great lady.
Supportive.
Very supportive. And she was very familiar with the music world, let's put it that way. And Lynn is one of the kindest people I've ever met. And she's a really good drummer, too.
Oh.
She would jump on the tubs and play Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat.
Oh, nice.
It's pretty impressive. She could swing.
Nice.
And I remember one night, because we'd sit around and listen to records and drink some wine, and we were listening to, if memory serves, at least in my memory, it's the first Rykuda record that Van Dyke Parks produced with him.
Yep.
And I remember listening to a track, and we were probably 20 or 21 years old. And we were very into country music at that point. So he and I both learned to play the banjo and mandolins. And we were also huge band fans. That's the other part of the multi-instrumental. When Mike and I met, he introduced me to those guys. Because I'd heard the music through Dylan.
Yeah.
But he introduced me to that. And Richard Manuel and Rick Danko. I mean, Richard's probably one of my absolute top favorite musicians.
I made a point of going to find Richard's... Richard's grave
in Stratford.
Yeah, in 2001, I took who I didn't know at all at the time, really, but my now wife and I were both doing school, and we had to go to Stratford to see one of the plays. And I said, before we go to the play, and it was pouring rain, I took her and our other friend, and I'm like, we have to find this grave. I was just so obsessed with the band at the time. And I've named my son after Levon Helm.
Oh.
So I'm a big... We have a lot in common.
Yeah, we got a lot in common.
Yeah, sorry.
So, no. And I digress there just to say that I remember we were listening to a Rykuda record. I think it was My Old Kentucky Home, if memory serves. And I remember she laughed and she was like, if it was 1970, you guys would be millionaires.
Right. With the music you make.
Yeah. But then she was like, but never forget, you know, I'm paraphrasing, of course. It's a very old memory, but it was a sign of the effect of, like, it's not it's not 1970.
Yeah.
Like, you get the memo, like, this isn't 1970. Like, don't think, don't expect, like, time changes everything. And if you can't get that clocked, especially with the art, you're going to be a very unhappy person, you know? And so anyway, I mean, so my digression to this was talking about photography, because I got very into cinematography when I was a teenager. And probably, you know, probably a third of my life's been spent watching movies. And the biggest impact on me still, I mean, I've been kind of drawing my mind back to the things that were really formative, was discovering Cassavetes and Rolands and their entire universe. And I discovered that incredibly early. Mm-hmm. I saw Killing of a Chinese Bookie late one night when I was probably 10 years old. Hmm. We used to watch a lot of inappropriate things. I didn't even know what it was until years later.
Right.
And, you know, getting into that stuff when I was probably 15 or 16. And again, this egalitarian, homemade thing, you know, this is homemade art,
rather,
you know?
Authentic, a little bit verite,
and just like, it's like, but also for me it was, there's a great interview with him from French television, was it Cinéaste de Temps, like, you know, filmmakers of our times, and it's when they're making faces and him talking about doing it for their delectation,
right,
and not in some selfish way, but it's like, we are doing this for ourselves and our friends, and this is what we're doing. This is what we love. This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And there's a funny line from him, because they lost, you know, I think Woman Under the Influence cost $300,000 to make, and it made like $50 in the week that it played.
Right.
Literally. And, you know, he's like, it cost me $300,000, and I'll spend $300,000 again on the next one. Like, I don't care. This is what I do. This is what we do.
Right.
And that always really stuck with me. And so, to me, that's very political.
It is.
That's and of itself. So I guess that's what I'm saying. And then with the music itself, because, again, I mean, I guess, you know, especially like when we were growing up, I mean, it was, you know, the grunge era, hardcore. I mean, this was a repulsive culture to me.
Right.
Like, utterly repulsive. There was never, you know, like, I'm good friends with Damien Abraham.
Right.
You know, I've known Damien since we were 16. But there was, I never found, also, I burned through my punk rock phase when I was 11, 12 years old. So, you know, it's a bunch of people screaming and making a bunch of racket. It was like, well, I was listening to Ornette Coleman records, and not to sound like snobby in myself, but it just seemed rather absurd, and it seemed rather classless, frankly. You know, it's like, it's just, there was very little resonance. You know, especially when you're listening to, you know, listen to Bill Evans.
Well,
you know, it was hard to, and also it didn't seem any fun. You know, like guys, I love rock and roll, and
I will meet you there,
and pop.
I will meet you there. There are aspects of punk and hardcore or post hardcore that didn't. I always had fun in those zones, but people would notice me having fun and say, "I noticed you were smiling while you were playing that song, and that's not normal." And so, like, that was
this is anathema to me.
Yeah,
this is like.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is like cultural genocide.
Right.
Like, this is nuts.
Right.
And it's really, and this is how, you know, this is, you know, it was just repellant to me. So the psychedelic thing, I guess.
Right.
you know, which again, it just sort of became like, and this goes back to my connection with a lot of the Americans, where it was, I could deal with people where you could take in a whole satellite world of things. That was even a huge part of meeting Jeremy Strawn.
Yeah.
Because Jeremy and I could talk about, you know, Don Caballero and Captain Beefheart and Doc Boggs.
Freedom. I think there's something, the principle or common element to everything that you're into is that you, those artists and yourself, are really invested in experiencing freedom, of spreading the word about freedom,
mm-hmm.
you know, suggesting that it is possible to be truly free.
Yeah, and also trying to not be didactic about it.
Exactly.
And trying to, you know, one
freedom
thing...
Freedom means different things to different people.
The one thing I learned from, you know, not to get in, not, you know, but one thing I learned a long time ago is, you know, trying to tell people what to do is a big waste of time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and maybe that's sort of what I'm saying about a lot of this stuff, where it's sort of like, you know, also having a bunch of like skinheads, like angry skin, white skinheads.
Yeah.
You know, trying to tell me that whatever garbage they're listening to is better than Sly Stone is absurd.
Sure.
It was absurd when I was 15 years old,
yeah.
And it's absurd now.
Right.
And, you know, also how people, you know, put up real lines around a lot of things, you know, and in a completely self-destructive way. The only reason I bring up complaining is I just feel like stuff we were talking about before we came on, just how people aren't honoring a lot of stuff right now. Because like I said earlier, I mean, like I could sit here and just enumerate artists to you. We talk for an hour, and these are people that are at least, if not better, than their antecedents.
Yeah,
that's part of my thing with David Berman. I mean, Berman, like, there aren't really antecedents, first of all, because it was such a
by his own observation, there weren't people who really followed him to push him out of the realm he'd created.
Well, yeah, and I was just going to say about him is, I mean, he is peerless, very much so. Because I will say, in his passing, revisiting the work and reading it as you listen,
yeah,
there aren't other songwriters that really go there. The only, some of Joni's stuff from the mid-70s is quite readable, but not as consistent as him.
Yeah.
You know, it's as rigorous as Christofferson or any of the, or Towns, and yet, you know, it was such a deep work, and not to say that this is somehow all of our failing, but it's like, I don't understand how people just, this isn't good enough.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you and I connected again recently for this tribute to David in Toronto, which I appreciated you inviting me to take part mm-hmm. in.
Absolutely, you're the first person I thought of.
It's nice, it's kind of you to do so, and I will say, I said it, I think, that night, that We and I'm trying to jump springboard from what you were just saying before you brought up David to how I felt about David and how I've been feeling about David since we had this really impactful evening together in Toronto with everybody. Loving David, because he didn't tour very much, and I think because he put out his records, and in fact, I was in love with this guy and his work, having never seen him
mm-hmm.
for years,
mm-hmm.
for years, just for years and years. It was maybe 11 years since I first heard his voice on a record and before I got to see him play live. And that's not normal. And so it became this very, I was just used to liking David in a very solitary way. There wasn't a social dynamic to it. A few friends and I would talk about David and Silver Jews, but there is something, like when we had that night together and people were reading his poems out loud, which I've read his poetry by myself. I've listened to his music mostly by myself.
To interject one thing,
yeah.
The standout, I don't have the program.
Yeah.
The woman from Edinburgh
yeah.
who read, I feel like that really put it over for me. It was just powerful. Anyway, so
the notion of feeling like I've just sort of come to expect that certain people who are great are not going to be appreciated until they're gone. Mm-hmm. And so when David left, we all felt that. Like, he didn't feel... We don't know what he was thinking, yeah, obviously, he was sort of saying in his interviews, you know, I've got 10 fans. Like, there's 10 people who've told me they like me in mm-hmm. my life. Mm-hmm. And he was feeling... Which can't be true, I don't think, but... I think that you're onto something there on a I don't know, philosophical level, as something going on within us where we need to really praise the people that deserve it.
Well, my friend John Maloney, who he's been the leader of Sunburned Hand of the Man out of the East Coast. John's one of my favorite people I know. Very. Very insightful, very funny man. And I think he said this in the Wire magazine 15 years ago. He referred to it as the arm folder generation. Hmm. And I remember laughing with him about this a couple years ago and talking about how, because again, I'm not talking about kids. Like, I'm not, if you know, like, I'm not talking about kids right now. I'm not
talking about our generation.
I'm talking about our generation, exactly. I'm just trying to let the listeners know that I'm not like some old fart complaining about kids. It's the furthest thing from it with this. But our generation, that everyone came to events, they would fold their arms. And the joke John and I made, or John made really, was that everyone stands there, they watch what's happening on stage, and say, I could do that.
Right.
If I had X, Y, Z, and especially the sort of more academic-y part of things, which we experience a lot here, you know, it's part of the Canadian thing, which mm-hmm. is part of why I radiate more to the down south.
Yeah.
It's sort of just more about work. I look at all this very, very blue collar too, and I don't mean that as I'm some working class hero sitting in my, you know, Tony apartment in Midtown Toronto.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's always how I've looked at it. So maybe even all that baggage, like, I'm not putting all this stuff, you know, it's like me putting out Upper Canada Blues. That isn't my entire identity being foisted on the world.
Right.
That isn't how it works for me. It's work. You work for the music, you work for the songs, you do as best you can, and then you move along. Rather than it having all these other things going on. Also, people don't have, you know, humor is a big part of my world too. And not to say that people shouldn't be completely bent right now. Like, I think anyone's justified in almost any state of mind at this point.
It's rough out there.
It is, but it's, again, talking about from the creative place, it's like my friend Wolfgang Nessel, who I mentioned earlier, Wolfgang and his partner Victoria Chong, who goes by New Chance, who makes amazing music. And Victoria is a fantastic artist.
Yeah.
And just does awesome stuff.
Yeah.
But they ran Healing Power Records, which was a small imprint here in Toronto.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I'm not sure if it's continuing. It's definitely in, you know, chill. I know they haven't put anything out in a while. But they represented a lot of the underground here. And Wolfgang and I used to present a lot of events. We did a festival here in 2006 called The Bummer in the Summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Named after the Arthur Lee song. Mm-hmm. Also, the opening night of the festival was the day Arthur Lee died, which was a completely cosmic...
Oh, strange.
Cosmic happenstance, yeah. Which there isn't, you know. but Wolfgang and I, from the very beginning, going back to that period, we always just talked about... And with our friend Marco Landini... who helped us with that festival, and Iris Fraser, the filmmakers, and Aaron Lumley. There was a gang of us, about five or six of us, who really put that together. But we talked about just creating the option, that is sort of the fundamental to this, which I think in and of itself is a very political act, without it being overtly political, you know, without having to like smash people over the head with it. It's like, no, it's up to us to create an option for people to radiate to. Because
right.
I sort of how I see this stuff without being a complete flake with, you know, hair to my behind. but that's sort of what this stuff is. Also, that attitude from the 90s, the grumpy, too cool for school snob thing, was ludicrous to me. It's still ludicrous to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Right.
I mean, that was a huge part of Mike and I's bond. I mean, we just couldn't believe it, the self-seriousness of the whole trip, especially with someone like Mike who, you know, I mean, Mike's, you know, without being hyperbolic, I mean, Michael's the finest musician. There's no one better.
Yeah.
Like, I can literally, I mean, you know, I can futz around with some of these things. I can play a few instruments well, but he's on a whole other level, and he's like a symphonic person.
Yeah.
So a bunch of people, you know, I don't know, just a bunch of rather affluent people being cheesed off, and that being their like cultural trip, and then kind of tearing down people who are, you know, who are demonstrably better than them, you know, like take Rockets Red Glare, you know, I remember seeing those guys play for the first time, and I didn't sit there and gnash my teeth being like, oh my, they make, you know, aren't I such a loser? I don't see it that way. It's like, wow, look at what they're making.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's tell everyone we know.
Right.
This is an amazing thing to behold. And, you know, I mean, this is endemic of people, and this isn't just, but I think that this stuff really got ratcheted up during the 90s into the aughts. And then people also kept, it's like, you know, people are still reading the New York Times. I mean, it's like mind bending to me.
What do you mean?
Like, it's crazy. Like, these, I don't know, just stuff that's it'd be like me complaining about, like, can you believe that Rolling Stone is no good? You know, it'd be like kvetching about that. It's like, yeah, these outlets have been rubbish for decades.
Right.
And yet everyone still goes back to the well, and, you know, it's like everyone watching the least bad thing on Netflix.
I understand.
And it's like, you know, Charlemagne Palestine's still alive. Like, Marion Zazila and Lamont Young are still alive. David Hammons is still alive.
Right. Why are we not...
Like, David Hammons is still alive.
Why are we stuck on...
William Eggleston
is
still alive.
Why are we not celebrating them?
Like, Robert Frank died last week.
Right.
And then everyone bloviates about all this stuff, and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, 94-year-old guys do die. but it sort of gets into this thing where it's like, well, yeah, maybe you should have, like, maybe people, you know, Henry Flint lives. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Right.
And, you know, it's... I mean, people, you know, I mean, it's maybe also, let's be honest too, the wealth of stuff coming to the surface in the last 15 years, because there is no underground anymore.
Right.
The underground is gone. If you want to read a good little bit on that, David Keenan, who the novelist who wrote England's Hidden Reverse, the book on Coyle and all that, you know, Nurse with Wound, who's a major Wire contributor. He and his wife, Heather Lee, Heather Lee's one of the best musicians out there. She plays with Peter Brotman, pedal steel player.
Okay.
She was in Cher Lambides, the Texas psychedelic band with Tom and Christina Carter. Amazing people, but Heather Lee and David ran a distro / record store called Volcanic Tongue in Glasgow. And Volcanic Tongue was one of the most important public services anyone's done in the last several decades. It was, David would, you know, every week there would be an update on what they were carrying in the store. And I mean, I think David wrote a couple million words in the end about underground records over a 10-year period, to 10-year period. And they were the place to get real underground records when that was still a thing, when you could you could exist. You know, you could, and between the internet and just all the mitigating financial problems with the, you know, early 21st century, they folded up about 5 years ago, or 5 years ago. And he wrote an essay in The Wire called Subtrain Homesick Blues, which was about him and Thurston talking about how there was no underground anymore.
Right.
So all I was going to say about that is, you know, this flood of stuff, you know, all the things that were once completely hidden. You know, it's like the theater of the eternal music, or the theater of eternal music. The Lamont Young stuff. I mean, you could root around and sniff it out, and it was incredibly hard to hear any of that stuff. You know, there was micro editions then. Even on file sharing, you can hear any of that music. You can walk into any record store in the world and buy that stuff now for $40. It's all, you know, it's like or a lot of the Japanese stuff.
Is this good or bad?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think access is incredible.
Yeah.
It's like take Max Turnbull. I met Max, I guess Max was probably 15 years old when I met him. I was working at CD Replay on Yonge Street beside the old Uptown Theater at Yonge and Bloor in Toronto. And it was me and a couple guys and a bunch of high school girls were at the store, and one of whom was Simone TB, the drummer, who was in a band called Tropics with Max Turnbull.
That's
and
right.
Simone plays with all kinds of people. He plays a partner and Simone Schmidt in those bands. And Simone TB is just, I mean, still one of my best friends. She's my drummer now.
Darlene Shrug,
thank you. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm trying to put all together, but
Simone and Max are on this show together, actually.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
And and Simone's been playing all the shows I've been doing for these LPs.
Right.
It's been amazing. And we hit it off instantly. And they were like 15, 16-year-old kids. And meeting them then, this is probably, I don't know, 04, 05, something like that, somewhere in that zone. And I met Anthony Nemeth, who works in that crew. Tony goes by Tony Price.
Yeah.
He works with
Ben Cook.
Yeah, Ben Cook, and he works with Meg Remy as well.
Right.
Anthony recorded Upper Canada Blues and the Some Horses Run album that I put out last year. And meeting all of those kids, you know, it was amazing because this was, you know, file sharing was happening. I think YouTube had surfaced, or I can't remember if it was there yet. I was pretty out of all that stuff. I mean, I just got a mobile like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I know. We've been trying to connect.
Yeah. and meeting them and how versed they were in the German music, the British progressive stuff, you know, heavy stuff. I mean, I was just kind of blown away, and I could see the access and being like, okay, so the people that are going to get into this now are going to get all the way in. You know, they're going to get up to their armpits, which we couldn't really. You know, I mean, we could find some of those records, but I'm still buying records now that I've been looking for since I was 13 years old.
Right. And they're available. They're more readily available now.
Yeah. I mean, but stuff that, like, they only existed in our imagination a lot of times. It's like you was reading lists. And now we literally anything we could walk on YouTube and boot it up and listen to it. And I mean, I think it's overwhelming. I think that leads to comfort food. I know it does for me, certainly, like when it comes to culture. It's like sitting there being like a, you know, this endless panoply of stuff. I mean, you know, you can't just live on Ubu Web. It's like it can be a little tiring.
It also seems to me, and I mean, this might just be my time of life, but I wonder if an artist like David Berman would cultivate the kind of close listening he deserves in this atmosphere when there's just so much you have to keep up with. And, you know, you mentioned the level of content that's available to be immersed in is amazing, but I go through it all the time. Like, I can't. In my work, I'm just constantly listening deeply as I can to a record, talking to someone like you, and then probably moving on. Whereas as a youth, I can still rap every lyric on the first Wu-Tang album because I listen to it over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with David or somebody like that or Pavement or whoever. Like, I would just it's again, it's probably a time of life thing. There's probably kids doing that still. But it's interesting because we're more conditioned to be omnivores culturally and be on top of every TV show, movie. Like, everyone's talking about a thing. I got to do the thing. Like, it's promotion is so weird now.
Which see, this is maybe what goes back to what I was saying about honoring things, because if we leave it up to the PR, my dad used to always say this. He was like, see, my dad's been saying this since the like 80s. It's like, is that public relations will win and we will all lose because of it, basically.
But it's more insidious now.
Well, and here's what I was going to say,
they've
though.
They've turned PR in. We are the PR.
Well, exactly.
On social media talking about Beyonce's new hat or
well,
whatever.
See, this is what I'm saying. It's like, I'm also the way I look at life, essentially. I mean, you know, by looking at any one thing, you're inherently not looking at everything else. It's the nature of a vision. So, as you said, it's like, yeah, if everyone's rubbernecking the same cultural dumpster fire, this is like what's always driven me crazy. Also, I'm voracious. I read the news, like I read three or four newspapers every day, and I probably read five or six music blog paper whatever every day. You know who's in the news every day? Every single day. If this doesn't make you want to slit your wrist, nothing will. Weezer, Blink-182, and David Bowie. They got a news story every single day because the machine is on.
Yeah.
It is set to high, and they will get a news story every single day. And if that doesn't make you want to kill yourself, I don't know what does.
Wow.
And it's absolutely repulsive.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, this is all garbage. Bowie was always got some good tracks, but it's like, are you kidding me? It's like a nightmare.
Yeah.
So the flip side of that, what you're saying, is that what needs to happen is, no, I should not say that, because I should not say what anything I will not prescribe anything.
Sure.
But good example. This summer, my friend Kevin Morby, who is an old friend of mine and who's just amazing. If you get a chance to see him and his new band, the Oh My God Band, it's the best show I've seen probably in a couple years. And one of the most uplifting things I've seen in a very long time. It was a sold out show at the Opera House. I was taking some pictures backstage and I got to look out at the crowd. And it was a sea of people, all shapes, sizes, colors, ages, a lot of young people. And I got to see people singing along to every word, people crying. And, you know, him, you know, who else? I mean, like my friend Steve Gunn, Meg Baird, like a lot of people that I know, I'm checking in on with them about what's going on out there. And it's like, you know what? Like, people are down. There's like a real need for this stuff. Maybe that's what I'm saying about all this, is there's a real need for this stuff, and that people need to be, like I said earlier, like the Bill Graham, to go back to 60s rock and roll, who was the promoter and who basically made the San Francisco scene.
The Fillmore.
See, I'm really into certain numerical things and statistical stuff sometimes. So the Fillmore and the Avalon are the two rooms he booked. Fit like a couple thousand people in them. There was like 800,000 people living in San Francisco at that point. That's it.
Uh-huh.
They filled those places 2-3 nights a week, all the time. And part of the deal was, his line was, you blow people's minds. So one person brings two people. The next time, those people spread. And the small is beautiful does slowly grow.
Yeah, right.
And again, I'm not talking about some huge global takeover. I think that's a big part of the sales pitch that happened to our generation, was it's like, oh, so you're either a millionaire or you're a loser. It was just like total binary.
Right.
Rather than being like, really, can't we just like make some stuff, continue to make some stuff, slowly grow, which is a huge part of me binding with Matt and Erica. Because, I mean, them, my friends Woods, you know, these aren't people that are on the cover of magazines. These aren't, you know, and yet they've been doing a small, slow thing. I mean, I always call it clients. An old friend of mine who is a health worker, he always just say to me, he's like, just look at it all as your clients.
Right.
The people that are, and not in like a, like, I'm above you, I'm selling you something, but being like, no, these are my, these are the, you know, so as long as you deal with your clients. And, you know, if you have 50 clients this year and you got 100 next year, that's 100% growth.
Right.
You know, and so I only bring up that Bill Graham stuff too, because take Toronto. I mean, this has been losing me, you know, bookings. But there's 6 million people in Toronto. There's 6 million people here.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard to book a 200-seat venue without a hassle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the onus is completely on the artist without getting into all this stuff. And that there's nobody who's, like, hyping stuff. That's sort of, I mean, that's sort of what I'm saying. It's like the voices who used to be, like, direct your eyes this way. For whatever reason, a lot of turkeys got deputized, first of all. I still can't believe some of the people that boiled up to the top. I mean, it's just flabbergasting to me. And then people just don't seem to pay attention also to the really great people, like Amanda Petrusich,
yeah.
You know, Jesse Jarno, you know, there's some really good people out there writing, like, really powerful, thought-provoking stuff that could really get people into stuff.
Right.
But, you know, it's it doesn't get the eyeballs, even from the people who are supposed to be the people. Maybe that's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
That was something I learned from record stores, was like all the people that, you know, talk the biggest talk. It's like gear stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's like all these guys who had now their homes, you know, rather than being full of trading cards, are now full of modular synths.
Right.
You know, it's like so depressing.
Yeah.
It's like, show me a record.
Well,
or show me, you know, or show me some joy.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
like that's, you know what I'm, you know what I mean? It's like,
I do.
It's like, you know, if you're going to collect stuff and whatever, go right ahead, but have some joy about it and don't lord it over or whatever.
I mean, for your part, you've been very prolific of late. I mean, we're talking about a record that you made 2 weeks after finishing your other solo record.
Yeah.
There's a Cosmic Range record that came out this year as
well. Yeah, in February.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Do you already have a plan?
There's another songwriter record that Jeff McMurrich and I are just finishing up. Hopefully going to be out in the springtime. It's more hi-fi, let's put it that way.
Oh, okay.
It's more, a bit more fastidious, let's put it that way. Still recorded here at the house, but I think it's a bit of a step up. So I'm just working on that. Was in the studio last week, going to be in there later this week. I've been doing some recording with my friends from the band Mr. Joy, who are a local band, very, very Elephant Six, almost Canterbury, like sort of Robert Wyatt-y in ways. Some of the nicest guys I've met in a really long time. Really good spirit. They make a great sound. And I got a real soft spot for a lot of that, like Olivia Tremor Control and that stuff.
Yeah.
And they're really young guys, so it was great. You know, we were working, and I was like, oh, this sounds just like Dusk at Cuba's Castle, and they didn't know what I was talking about, which is marvelous, which is maybe going back to what we were saying. It's like people are going to, because you sort of, people get to this place through a million different routes.
It's sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then it just becomes, because to me, it was always about sharing this stuff, right? Like, I'm the person that if I ask you, like, hey, you know, you ever seen Casablanca? And you say no. I don't roll my eyes. I'm like, awesome. That means we get to watch Casablanca, right?
Sure.
Like that, or at least I try. I do my best to imbue that. You
right.
know, I know I can also be like, you know, I was a terrible grumpy record store guy. I'm still getting over that. but Mr. Joy stuff. So we're working on that. We might call it Dr. Joy. We've been sort of joking about
okay,
because people call me Doc.
Oh, right. Why do they call you Doc?
You have to ask MV.
Okay.
MV lays handles on.
So you're Matthew Doc Dunn is what you go by.
Yeah, usually, because I get a lot of credits with just Doc and stuff. So
right.
And I respond to if you yell Matthew or Doc or Dunn at me, those are the three things that'll make me turn my head.
Okay, got it.
So I have that stuff on the horizon. What else? There's an album called Stonegrass that I made with my friend Jay Anderson, the drummer.
I know Jay.
Jay and I played in a million projects over the years. We were in a band called the Spiritual Sky Blues Band a bunch of years ago that was never really documented.
Okay.
It was the two of us and Gavin DeAnda from Saffron Sect and The Gnostics and whatnot. And Gavin's living in Montreal now. And, you know, I've also been trying to document a lot of stuff that wasn't documented properly way back.
Okay.
You know, lack of urgency in documenting a lot of things from a lot of people around here. So Jay and I made that with Anthony Nemeth, and it's instrumental. And that's going to come out really soon. There's the Live Woods tape that's come out on my label that is just finished, called Live Love, that is a compilation of recordings my friend Ayal Sr. made from the Herschel Savage American Flag Band. And I'm playing on a lot of it, and there's a bunch of other fun people on it, and so that's out. And hopefully some more Cosmic Range stuff. We're getting into some work. I'm hoping maybe we can get some more backing band work, like we did with U.S. Girls on Poem Unlimited, which was a big part of why I put that band together. I've always been a big fan of studio bands and just studio work in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was even part of probably Mike and I's multi-instrumental thing. You know, the idea of you can cut down on numbers by having people doubling, and we have a really, you know, kind of interesting skill set. I'm hoping some stuff will come of that, because I really enjoy it, you know.
Well, I mean, it's astounding. It's an amazing body of work already, and I thank you for the work you've done.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work, if possible?
The best place to go right now is to go on the Cosmic Range Records Bandcamp page.
Okay.
I think if you pretty much Google my name, that's the first thing that comes up. I don't do social media. Like I said, I didn't have a mobile until someone gave me one a couple weeks ago. Sort of a, you know, or actually the irony is it was given to me about a year ago and it sat on my shelf for a year.
I actually want to interject, because as you were talking about your lack of cell phone engagement, I went on my cell phone because as we've been speaking here, I thought about the fact that I suggested that the Beatles would have played RFK Stadium in 1964.
No, because RFK was still
Robert
alive.
Robert F. Kennedy. Why would they have named it that? I don't know what I was thinking, but it was actually called the Washington Coliseum.
The Coliseum, yes, exactly.
But for some reason in my head, maybe now it's called the RFK. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder if the Coliseum was renamed.
I don't even know if that's true. I think RFK is a stadium.
Right. Yeah, because RFK is where the team that should not be named plays.
Yes.
And it's outdoors.
I just thought of it as like about half an hour ago. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I got that wrong. I'm going to fix this.
Oh, don't get me.
So you're telling me about not using your phone. Sometimes these phones come in handy.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm pretty unimpressed, but hey, it's, you know, it's come in handy.
Yeah.
I get it. I also understand why people were incredibly cheesed off at me for not having one.
Yeah,
of
they're handy
things.
For getting in touch with people too.
Yeah, I was getting a little too isolated from the world, which is sort of what I do anyway.
But you're on Bandcamp.
I'm on Bandcamp, so you can access the records there.
Yeah.
I'm in the process of uploading a lot of the old tapes and the old private press records and stuff, sort of more of the avant-garde, for lack of a better word, which is a terrible word for this stuff. the instrumental music, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm going to start uploading a lot of that stuff to the Bandcamp, and you can just get in touch with me directly there.
Okay.
There might be an Instagram page going up for the label. I cannot confirm or deny that happening, but that's the best way for people to find me.
Okay.
And even taking a little dip into Discogs, because you know, there's a rather voluminous.
Yeah, you've been prolific.
Fairly prolific.
It's good.
Thank you. Especially with Matt and Erica and some of the other things, and a lot of session work up here for a lot of even people that are in the range and stuff. I'm on people's stuff, so
yeah.
And I do my best to try to, you know, not to sound too weird, but try to be on records that are good, so you can dig in and it's not like,
yeah,
like a whole, you know, it's like, okay, maybe there's some good stuff here.
So Upper Canada Blues, is it on a label?
No, I'm privately pressing all this stuff. I'm the label boss.
Okay.
Cosmic Range Records is,
that's you,
is my label.
Okay.
And then the band is the Cosmic Range,
right?
Which is maybe a little confusing, but it all feeds sort of back into the same place.
I'm figuring it out. If I can figure it out, most people can figure it out, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I also, not to be, I mean, I'm sitting here talking to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but you know, a little mystery, you know, it was always kind of fun part of all of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, so, you know, don't, you know, you don't want to always show your full hand.
You've
know?
Done some press though.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You'll do the press.
Yeah. I mean, with the right people.
Right. Well, you know? I appreciate you making time for me.
Yeah. I'm not trying to blow smoke.
No,
it's
no,
like,
no.
You know, it's like, you know, people I want to talk to for sure. And also I will say that, you know, the Berman stuff you posted was a really wonderful talk.
Oh,
and,
thanks.
And it was, you know, that was a big part of me being like, of course I'll talk to Vish.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
No,
it means a lot.
Yeah,
If there's a song from Upper Canada Blues that we can go out on for people to hear, what would you pick?
I'd probably put on Running Right Out.
Running Right Out. This is the penultimate song on this record.
Yeah, yeah, because, yeah, we'll play that one, because...
Why?
I think it's... MV and I used to always joke about having the Willie Nelson song in your kit bag, as in, if you met Willie Nelson, is there a song that you wouldn't feel embarrassed to play for Willie Nelson?
Oh, of your own.
Of your own.
Right.
And using that as like a...
standard.
Yeah, very much so. Being like, you know, do you have a song that you wouldn't be completely embarrassed singing for Willie Nelson? And I think that's maybe that.
Okay.
And I think it's got a nice hook.
All right, we'll leave it at that. It's mysterious.
It's a downer, which is great.
It's good. This is Running Right Out from Upper Canada Blues by Matthew Duck Dunn. Matthew, thank you so much for this time and for having me in your home, and I wish you the best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you, Vish. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Thanks again to Matthew Doc Dunn for appearing on this, the 515th episode and the first of the year 2020 of Creative Control. The first episode of Creative Control in the year 2020. And Creative Control is still part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available on all iOS and Android platforms, and also on things like Spotify and Audio Boom and YouTube and all those things as well. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for in any of those things, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. And once again, we have a $6 and above tier now. Anything $6 and above, you get exclusive access to content from my audio archives, and I'm uploading those whenever I can. So at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, depending on what's going on. So again, patreon.com/creativecontrol to support the show. And thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support for this show. And always Jim Guthrie. Thank you, Jim. Jim lets me use some music of his on this show, and you can learn more about him at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you very much for listening to this this podcast and telling your friends to do the same and subscribing to the show and all the things you do. I appreciate it very much. And I will talk to you very, very soon. Here's to a happy new year, 2020, and let's do this together. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.